Okay, so I'm Dan. Since it's after lunch and I know you're all tired, I'm going to try something new here. I'm going to give you the option of which talk I give. So I'm going to give a multi-option talk. So let me describe these options to you first. And I'm going to describe them in terms of several different objectives that you could achieve by receiving these talks. So the first one is Humid Ride, Dan's trip to the East Coast. This is a little bit like Uber's talk earlier today on Hot Ride, so I don't want to repeat this too much, but it's going to have a high amount of whining, a medium duration, and a low amount of viruses. Option two is T-cell attacking Dan's cold virus. It's going to be a medium amount of whining in this talk, a low duration, but very many viruses. And the third option is probably the default option if you don't want those other ones, is model light planning, diverse multi-option plans, and dynamic objectives, where there's going to be very little whining and very little viruses, but it's a little bit longer. So unless anybody has any objections, I'm going to go with option three. So this is joint work with Will Cushing and Raul Kamalpati at ASU. Now I'm working at SRI. So let's ask a few questions here before we get started. In designing a multi-option plan, one of the questions we want to ask is, when must our plan executor decide on their planning objective? Typically, what people do is they say, before synthesis, this is what I'm interested in. Give me a plan to do this. So this is the traditional classical planning model that all the PDL folks are very interested in. Another model is before execution, where say you have a plan library of several different types of plans, and you would use some type of information retrieval model to look at this set of plans and decide which one is most appropriate. The next option is during execution, whereas this is something I'll be hitting on here in multi-option plans. This subsumes the previous two. Third is, do we have to decide on the objective at all? Can we just start acting and get away with keeping our options open? So another question is, can the executor change their planning objective without having to replan? Finally, can we execute without committing to an objective at all? So what I'll do is describe how we can do this with diverse multi-option plans, and I'll describe what I mean by diversity, how we represent these types of plans, and show a connection to the conditional plans, and then finally how we would go about executing these plans. Then I'll talk a little bit about synthesizing these plans, and then I'll give an analysis of their synthesis and execution. So here's a few different travel plans that I considered when I was making my trip here. Starting out in Menlo Park, I could either take a shuttle or a train, fly from SFO to Boston, fly from Boston to Providence, or take a car from Boston to Providence. These are all different options that I could have taken. And if you look at these as a state space graph, what you'll see is it looks kind of like a conditional plan, where you have these branches depending on what your objective is. So if I plot these plans in this objective space here where I have a cost and a duration, they all lie in they're all non-dominated against each other. And what I mean by diversity is that it strongly relies on proto-optimality. So if I say these set of plans is diverse, the Euclidean distance between them is high. So what do we mean by dynamic objectives? So if we look at these branches as if they were branches in a conditional plan, what we'd be branching on is the uncertainty over what the user's objective function is. So if I had in my state what the user's objective was, but the state was uncertain, I could come up with plans that can branch based on when the user says, this is what I'm interested in, after they have started executing. And what the condition is on the user's objective function. And what this does is allows us for the user to change their objective function throughout the execution of the plan. They don't have to commit to saying, I care only about cost or only care about duration. So let's look at how we might execute one of these plans. So we start out, we have four options that we've plotted in our objective space, and we haven't yet chosen our first action we want to execute. So let's say that we want to take the train. What this is going to do is cross out a couple of these options that are no longer available. Then we move on to the next state. So now we have two options that both correspond to doing the same action. So at this point, we don't have to commit to either some objective function. An objective function would just be a line, a plane that's tangent to one of these points. So here we're retaining flexibility in what our objective is. This is a point, we have a decision point where we need to decide what is our objective, and say we choose to take a car from Boston to Providence. And now we're committing to this one single plan. If you'll notice that the values of these options is changing over time because you have executed part of the plan already, so you don't have to account for that extra cost or duration. So I want to look at a case study of this idea within specific planning problems, and I'm going to be doing this in a PomDP setting where we're doing a belief state space search, and this will work for either a PomDP or an MDP because I'm assuming you have an initial situation and you're just doing a reachability analysis in order to find a plan from that initial situation. So we're going to have the typical things we always have in PomDPs: stochastic actions, observations, initial state uncertainty, and loops. We have two objectives we're trying to optimize here. The first is expected plan cost. The second is probability of plan success. These are competing objectives that you can't have both in a plan necessarily. And in traditional MDP work, what happens is the reward function is coming up with one kind of linear combination of these two. And so what they're doing is picking their objective function before they even begin synthesizing their plan. And this is before they even know what the space of possibilities are for the plans. So what we'll do is we'll extend the LAO star algorithm to multi-option LAO star, where what we're going to do is, instead of for each state in the MDP assigning the best action to perform in that state, for the policy, we're going to assign a set of actions to perform. And these actions are going to be non-dominated with respect to each other. And then I'm going to show you conceptually what the dynamic programming operator looks like in order to define protosets. And the bad news is that it does take exponential time to compute this backup. I'll describe what that means. But there are good approximations to it, which I'll also describe. So the basic LAO star algorithm is more or less like this. While you don't have a good plan, expand your search space, then revise it by doing dynamic programming, and then you expand again. So the extension we're going to make is expand multiple plans and revise multiple plans at once. So let's look at our state space backup here, where we're trying to back up the state here. We have an action that has two outcomes, one with 0.2, one with 0.8 probability of them occurring. And they're going to reach these different belief states or states. Now, here we have two possible plans we could execute in here, pi 1 or pi 2. Pi 1 has a high probability of success, but it's very costly. Pi 2 is about medium for both. And for this state here, we have either pi 3 or pi 4. Now, when we want to do the dynamic programming to combine these to figure out what are the possible plans we could execute here, we have to look at the cross product of these protosets. And this is where you get the exponential factor in the backup. So you're going to have this set of potential plans that you could execute here, either where you perform A first, then pi 1, or pi 3, depending on the outcome, and so forth for the other options. So this is going to serve as kind of the basic meat of the algorithm, where you're performing the state backup. So I'll give you a small example of how this works. We're going to start with our initial situation here where we have zero probability of satisfying our goal. We're going to say that the goal is satisfied with zero probability and zero cost. So there's an empty plan here where we do nothing. And I'm also going to put a point here which is a heuristic estimate of what kinds of plans are out in the future that I should look for. So I do that with a heuristic. So when I expand this node, I get two possible actions, one A2, where I'm not achieving the goal, and then A1, which has two outcomes. In all of these cases, I have a heuristic estimate of what it's going to take to achieve the goal. And I'm just showing one where I'm saying, what is it going to take to give me the goal with 1.0 probability? So what we do next is we back up the state here. And what we see is that for the heuristic point, the best looking action seems to be A1. So what we're going to do is expand the plan through that. So now we see that it's possible to achieve the goal with 0.7 probability, and over here with 0.5 probability, and we have heuristic estimates of those plans. Then we do a state backup for all of their ancestors. So here we have the heuristic estimate of through the here and the cost of the null plan for stopping here or performing just action A4. And then we also have an actual plan of doing A1, then doing A4 or A3, and we know that that gives us some probability of achieving the goal. So then next we expand again. Here we're seeing that we can achieve the goal of 0.9 probability with another additional action. On the other side, there's no applicable action. So when we back up again, we're propagating this information from the expansion back to our root node, and we're seeing these are the possible plans we could execute. And now what's happened is that over here, because there's no applicable action, the heuristic estimate of achieving the goal with 1.0 probability is infinite, because there's nothing you can do there to achieve the goal. When you propagate this back to the root, it's saying that A2 is actually a better candidate for searching for a higher probability plan, because it was infinite on the other side. So now we expand this, and we see that it's possible to achieve the goal of 0.1 probability, and we backpropagate that back to our root node. Expand again here. We achieve the goal of higher probability. Now when we backpropagated all this information back to our root node, what we see is that there's a couple points here that are dominated, that, you know, doing the plan corresponding to those points in the predicate is not optimal. So we can just prune those. At this point, we say that we have a couple plans that are non-dominated. And we can either continue searching here to find more plans, or we can stop. And I won't talk about the conditions for stopping, because there actually isn't a good condition for stopping, because the problem is undecidable. Okay, so I showed you that those state backups is a source of the complexity for the algorithm. And I'll just describe one speedup that reduces that complexity a little bit using epsilon domination. So let's look at a Pareto set here where we have a bunch of points. And consider a grid like this where each of these rectangles, the coordinates, the ratio of the two is 1 plus epsilon. So what we're doing is dividing the space into these hyper-rectangles. And what we want to do is make sure there's only one point in each of these rectangles. So when we want to go and add a new point to the Pareto set, we multiply its objectives by 1 plus epsilon, and then we check and see if it dominates any of the points in the set already. And if it does, if it is dominated, if this point is dominated after you've multiplied the objectives, then you can prune it. Otherwise, you would see that this would be a non-dominated point that you could add. So what this buys you is that you get a polynomial number of points in the epsilon. So for another point here, it's added to a box that doesn't contain any other points. We can say it's non-dominated. So in this way, this has a cascading effect as we're doing the dynamic programming, where at the least, you're reducing the number of points that can happen there, and as you're combining them, taking this cross product that takes exponential time, you're actually reducing the number of nodes as you're chaining backwards. So this way, you're filtering a lot of nodes out, so final backups at the root node have very few points. Okay, so give you some results here. These are a set of partially observable domains. So I have listed the size of the problems here. The first three are I made up a domain called first responders. It's modeling first responders like an operator serving the fire department, the police department, to go about and put out fires and save victims and that sort of thing. There's partial observability because they don't know where the victims are and they don't know where the fires are initially, but they're getting reports coming in and they can figure out where to go. So these are different size problems with different numbers of actions, different numbers of state propositions, and different numbers of observations. And the other one's a grid navigation domain where there's a robot moving about a grid going from A to B, and moving, they go in the wrong direction with some probability. And they can observe the wall if they're next to the wall. So what I'm showing in this plot, I'll start here. What I'm showing along this axis here is the probability of goal satisfaction. So if I have a spike, that means that I found an option that achieves the goal with that level of probability. So initially, this is the time axis. So as I'm running the algorithm, I'm finding more and more options along here. So initially, I find some that are very low probability and have this z-axis is the cost. So as I'm moving along, I find more and more options, and eventually I start finding some very high probability options. And what this plane on here is just the Pareto set at the root node of the problem, which is your initial state. So it's stating what are the multiple options that I can choose from. So the user, if they wanted to execute one of these plans, they could pick any one of these points depending on what they, how much they're willing to spend in terms of the cost of the plan to achieve a certain level of probability of goal satisfaction. So in the table here, what I'm showing is a depiction of the time to take, that it's taken to find the plans, where this set here is using no search heuristic. And in these cases, I'm using a planning graph heuristic and some of the other work that I've done. And we see that you can't even solve these problems by without using a heuristic at all to guide the search. But what's interesting about the domains where you are able to solve using the heuristic, that what I'm showing here is the time it takes to find a plan with at least this much probability of goal satisfaction. So here I have 0.95, some 0.25 up to 0.95. So obviously it gets harder because you're finding more options as you go along. And so the time taken to find these is on the order of minutes. And some of the plans have an expected cost of, you know, 23, 40, 40 actions long. So this is how deep the conditional plan is. Then I have this here, which is stating how many nodes there are in the plan, like how many decision points there are in the plan where you have to execute an action. So in some of these, I have several hundred nodes in the plan. And then this column here, what I'm showing with DS, is the number of nodes where you've collapsed a branch. So it's showing how much of an acyclic graph it looks like, as opposed to a tree. And the final column here is the number of terminal nodes, which gives you an idea of how many branches in their plan. So you have on the order of 50 to 100 branches in some of these plans, which is, as far as I know, the largest you can find for some of these conditional planning problems. So how do we go about executing these plans? So I'm showing some plots that were similar to the plot on the previous page, where I was showing what are the options as the search algorithm is finding over time. But this is showing what are the options as I'm executing a plan over time. So I'm going to show you three different schemes for doing this. Let me just describe each of the plots before I describe the schemes. So I'm showing along this axis the plan step, and along this axis the different options, and the z-axis also is corresponding to the options. So on the first step, I have, you know, probably about 20 options here. After, you know, about 20 steps, I had probably like two or three options left. So the schemes that I use to execute these plans is assuming that you don't have an objective function at all. What can you do? The first thing is you can just choose a random option and execute that, which is this plot here. And what you see is you quickly run out of options as you're executing the plan. And the other schemes that I think are a little bit more sensible if you don't have an objective function is saying that you keep your options open. So the first one here is I'm choosing the action to execute that is in the most of the options. So this is kind of like the most flexible action because it doesn't constrain me to, you know, the fewest options. So here we see that we have quite a bit of options as you're executing the entire plan. Now here what I'm showing is the most diverse set of options. So you're comparing the Euclidean distance between all the points with all of the different options corresponding to each action. And you're choosing the action that has the most diverse set of options possible. And here what we see as you're executing out, you have a few more options at the very end of the plan. So in a sense, you're preserving some of your options for later. You're keeping your options open. So this is just an initial study, and this type of execution is very local. You're just looking at the step ahead of what you can do, but there's no sort of look ahead. So let me summarize. What multi-option plans give you is the ability to delay or change your commitments to your objective function throughout the execution of a plan. And it's also useful for decision makers to be able to see the set of options in front of them before they even commit to a single plan. And because we're doing this sort of approximation of these proto-sets in our particular search algorithm, we're enforcing a type of passive diversity where we're ensuring that no two options are very close to each other. So in future work, one of the things we're looking at trying to do is do proactive diversity. So if you have this Pareto set of options, they may be very skewed to one side, and you want to guide the search to finding options in the other points of the Pareto space. Then there's also a lot of speedups you can make to this using a lot of standard MPP techniques. There's a lot of things we could try in execution, like how far do we look ahead as opposed to just what are the options available now? And then there's also other types of objectives like diversity and decision delay. They're kind of meta objectives. And expanding upon the connection to model light planning, that initially was kind of the focus of this work, is that you may not even specify the objectives to the planning algorithm. It needs to figure out how to find these diverse plans without knowing what you're interested in at all. And you could also use this for objective function preference elicitation. So to conclude, I'll give you some final options. First one is to ask me some questions. Second one is to give me some criticisms. And the third one is for the next talk.